We're discussing power transition here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As crucial vote tallying carries on, demonstrators supporting President Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden took to the streets in anger in cities across the country. Supporters of Biden rallied around the chant, "Count every vote." President Trump supporters called out, "Protect the vote and stop the steal," a conspiracy theory that Democrats are attempting to steal the election. What do you think of President Trump's press conference yesterday evening, making false claims about the election? 800-642-1234. Rachel Kleinfeld is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's founding CEO of the Truman National Security Project. Rachel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, wonderful to be here.
So you're a member of the National Task Force on Election Crises. Is what we're seeing now before your task force, are we in a crisis?
Well, we planned for a whole series of crises. In fact, we actually planned a pandemic crisis long before the pandemic. We'd been planning for about 2 years, and that one we threw out as unlikely to happen. So
wow.
We're not perfect, but we formed with a single goal in mind. We wanted to ensure a free and fair election this year. And the good news is our election was free and fair. We had had a very good election day with very little going wrong, very few of the technical glitches and so on that we've gotten used to in recent elections. And a lot of what we're seeing now in terms of a slow vote counting process and people being concerned, it was pretty expected as well.
But there have been protests around the country calling for a complete count of the vote, calling to stop the vote, to protect the vote. You know, as you look at what is going on in the streets, what do you make of it?
Well, let's not get too overblown here. First of all, protest is something that is good in a democracy. You want people to be able to voice their opinion. So there's nothing to be scared of with peaceful protest. Second of all, it's actually not that many protests. If you compare it to this summer and the huge spike in protests over police brutality in June and then the ongoing protests throughout the summer, what we've really seen was protest in L.A., in Raleigh, North Carolina, D.C., and then in major cities, which you could expect. You can't have an election like this and not have people on the streets when you have, you know, million-person cities like Chicago and Detroit, Minneapolis, New York, that kind of place. But we're not seeing them all over the country. This is not 2016 when you had protests in 700 locations. We're just nothing like that. We've had them in about a dozen.
So put it into perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, none of them have been that big. And so far, none of them have been that violent. We're hoping that that continues through the weekend. But, you know, that depends on the goodwill of American citizens.
You said our country sets a low bar for itself when it comes to democracy compared to other countries around the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, I know it sounds awkward, but my work is in comparative democracies. I look at democracies all around the world. And for many, many years, democracies all around the world look to America as the gold standard. And we reveled in that belief about ourselves. But meanwhile, a lot of them were moving forward with different ways to hold elections. They were creating very strong nonpartisan election commissions that could determine what was right and what was wrong, that basically like referees that could call balls and fouls. They were creating better methods of holding elections in places where conflict could break out. They were creating better technology to ensure that votes were being counted in fair ways that everyone thought were fair and so on. America, our Constitution gave the power to hold elections to the states. And the states devolved some of that power to municipalities. And so we now hold 13,000 elections across the country. That's not bad in and of itself, but it means that we have wildly varying levels of ability in our election administrations and wildly varying levels of money. So this year, when every state changed rules, or almost all the states, I shouldn't say every, but nearly all the states changed their rules to accommodate a pandemic and these unprecedented times, and they needed extra money to buy hand sanitizer and gloves for election workers and just really basic things, the federal government didn't provide enough money. And so you had Facebook's foundation, Zuckerberg Chan's foundation, sending in $300 million so that our election could function. And this is not okay in the world's greatest democracy.
It costs money to put on election free and fair. How important is it to have the resources enable to carry out the vote?
It's very important. You just need some basics. You know, you need to have machines that work. You need to have poll trainers who have training on those machines. Plenty of states don't have much training for their poll trainers. And a lot of the first day glitches were, you know, early poll trainers who don't use computers a whole lot. A lot of our women run polls, generally speaking, and a lot of them are over 60, and they might not know how to use this new technology. I can speak for myself as someone who balks at new technology. You know, so these things take money and they take some time, and you can't just assume that they'll happen. We have an amazing staff of election officials at the local level who are just doing their jobs, you know, just trying to figure out how to run a strong, safe election. And they're still doing their jobs doing these counts. But we sure could use some help for them.
Yeah, you know, Wisconsin has 1,850 clerks around the state. My guess is that they have a whole lot of other responsibilities besides carrying out an election, and some may not even be full-time, and they're working around the clock to execute an election and make sure that every call is received and make sure that every, anything that comes up, every problem is solved.
That's exactly right. I mean, I remember earlier, these days have been very long. It might have been yesterday. It might have been the day before. Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, they took a break from counting, and the demonstrators, you know, well, is this fraud? What's going on? What it is a bunch of exhausted people who've been sitting on folding metal chairs with no cushions for 14 hours or however long at that point, needing a break. You know, these are human beings trying to count and trying to do their best with long, long hours. And those long hours, by the way, are because of political decisions. They're because some states like Michigan decided not to allow poll workers to spell each other and work in shifts. It had to be the same people in certain cases. Other states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, decided not to allow early counting to happen of absentee votes the way that Florida and other states of both political parties, I should say, changed their rules so that knowing that they were going to get this huge influx of absentee ballots, they could start counting early when they came in, or at least start processing them early, getting them opened and check for signatures and all that sort of thing. But those three key states chose not to, and they chose not to for political reasons. And that's why we're in this situation right now.
When you look at other countries around the world, have they been able to remedy those seemingly simple type solutions in order to streamline the process?
It depends on the country, of
course.
Mm-hmm. But if you look at, say, India's famed electoral commission, they carry out an election in waves for a billion people. That's three times the size of the United States, a continent with extremely poor roads and monsoons and all the rest of it. And the level at which they manage that election is stunning to behold. Indonesia, similarly, a country spread across thousands of islands, manages a strong election. There's really a need in America for our electoral system to modernize and get better. But a lot of what's going on here is not just an election system that sort of technocratically isn't functioning. Our election system doesn't function all that well because political parties make decisions that they think will help them. And in order to help themselves, they don't want to help the basic election system.
We're discussing our election process with Rachel Kleinfeld from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's on the National Task Force on Election Crises. What are your thoughts on protests, demonstrations taking place? Are you taking to the street as well? Are you concerned about recounts? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Rachel Kleinfeld here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the presidential transition of power here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Concerns about a potential handoff of presidential power have ramped up since Wednesday when the president prematurely declared that he had won the election. According to the Washington Post's heat map on where votes are still being counted, there are still more than a million votes left to be counted in Pennsylvania, in Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, and Georgia. Do you think our country can carry this out? What are you watching for? Join in at 800-642-1234. Rachel Kleinfeld is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a member of the National Task Force on Election Crises, and she stays with us for the hour. Rachel, what is the role of recounts in a free and fair election? What do you see as recounts emerge?
So recounts are an absolutely appropriate part of a free and fair election. They're something that are very easy to do, actually, in America compared to a lot of other countries. Wisconsin, for instance, you're allowed to do a recount. The challenger has to pay unless the recount is within a margin of victory of 0.25% or less. So if the margin of victory is a quarter of a point or less, Wisconsin pays. If it's greater than that, the challenger pays. In Wisconsin's case, it was 1%. So if the Trump campaign asked for a recount, they would pay. That's fine. And when Wisconsin conducted recounts in 2016 and 2004 and 2000, it's happened a number of times, and it shuffled very few votes usually.
Yeah. This election turnout looks like to be the largest voter turnout in decades. What do you make of turnout?
So that's another of the good news stories, and it's something to really report. Turnout is extremely high across all demographics as far as we can see. Youth turnout is extraordinarily high. And I think what that says is that while our country is divided on a number of issues, we believe in the vote. We believe our voice matters, and we believe that having a legitimate election is a way of expressing that voice. That is a wonderful sign for our democracy. And the fact that so many people who came out are first-time voters or not regular voters is also wonderful. And so while it's easy to focus on the story of divisiveness, it's important to focus on the story that people are making their voices heard in a peaceful way that democracy is supposed to work. And Our elections have long been decided by less than a majority of our electorate, and that is not the case this time, and that is good.
Here in Wisconsin and around the country, it seems that, you know, absentee ballots, mail-in ballots have really been the way that voters can get their ballot in a pandemic and feel safe in voting in a global health crisis. What do you see there? And even comparing to other countries at how a ballot is cast?
So ballots are cast differently in many different countries. But in America, we've long had states that have cast ballots absentee or by mail only. So Oregon's done it for 20 years. Colorado has done it for many years. Places like California and Arizona had permanent registries of vote by mail individuals that covered a significant portions of their electorate, Hawaii. So this was not unknown to certain states. And I have to say, having lived in Colorado for a number of years, it's a real convenience even when there's no pandemic. I was living in Colorado with a very young child and baby, and voting by mail rather than trying to take your squalling toddler and baby into a voting booth at the same time sure is nice. So there's a lot of positives to this. And I think the pandemic obviously vastly accelerated it across the country. What we're seeing now, though, are some of the results of that, which is that Oregon, Colorado, Utah, the states that had vote by mail for many, many years, had a way of learning and getting better at holding those elections. And they created many, many ballot drop boxes to make it easy to drop off your votes. And they built signature tracking systems and all sorts of things. And the states that had to adapt very quickly, their voters weren't necessarily as used to it. And they also had many, many voters who feared the process, in part, of course, because of the president's rhetoric about that process.
We're talking with Rachel Kleinfeld from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We're looking at voting in America, what we can learn from other countries, and what we see now. Join in with your questions and for conversation about the 2020 election and how it's put together. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at wpr.org. Like any election, Rachel, there was a ton of polling leading up to the election, and it's being said that polls, you know, got it wrong this time around. It wasn't, you know, just a blue wave as the polls had predicted. What is the influence of polling at the ballot box?
So our polls have been inaccurate a number of times now, and I think it is really time for that industry to look themselves in the eye and see what harm they're doing to the democracy. Because when expectations are so different from reality, it causes people to wonder what's going on. You see that in every country around the world. When expectations from polls are quite different from the reality on the ground, people think that that there's fraud and all sorts of things. I think what's happening in our world is a couple of things. First of all, with the advent of cell phones, lots of people are just refusing to take poll calls. Either they're getting screened as spam, or people are just saying no and hanging up. So you're getting these extraordinarily low rates of answering, 1 to 3%. Who's that 1 to 3%? It's not me. I'm a busy working mom and wife. It's, you know, it's a lot of people who might not be your average voter. And while they try to control for that and they try to use statistical models to control for that, it's not perfect. The other thing that seems to be happening is that people are afraid to admit that they're voting for who they're voting for. Hmm. And in this case, Trump clearly came out far ahead. And so it seems like a lot of people just didn't want to admit that that was their choice. And we knew that ahead of time. And yet the lure of numbers, the desire to look at a chart or a picture and say that's where we're going, is so strong that people ignored what the other half of their brain knew, which was that a lot of people didn't want to answer these polls and a lot of people didn't want to answer them accurately.
One journalist in The Guardian I was reading this morning said, journalists will continue to create charts predicting future presidents as long as readers continue to demand them. And seeing graphics that tell us the future is hypnotic, but it is important to be awake when you read those charts. You know, what do you make of that? That this is just part of the you know, the media cycle, if you will.
I think it is, and I think the media in America is not used to the elections that we're having now. America's entering a phase of what we in the international democracy space call affective polarization, and it's a dangerous space. What it means is that people aren't just voting for their party because they love their party. They're voting against the other party because they fear the other party, and they fear the other party because they're worried that the other party will hurt the democracy itself or will hurt their deepest identity. So when you're in that kind of a space, journalism plays a different role. It's not just an investigatory role. It's not just a role of informing the people. It's actually a role that says we are core to our democracy and we need to maintain a place where people feel heard. We need to make sure that conflict is low. We need to make sure we're not inciting violence or making people think things that aren't true. And so there's a whole series of ideas that we know from other countries about what's called conflict-sensitive journalism or journalism in places where elections are contested. And I tried to write a paper about those with a fabulous journalist, Amanda Ripley, and get it to journalists ahead of the election. And I was stunned by how desired that was by many journalists in America who just never thought of their role that way. And the media here will have to start thinking about it that way, because clearly we're a divided nation, and that's not bad. People in a democracy are allowed to have different views, but we're going to have to manage that divide instead of pretending that we can just avoid it.
Well, let's bring in Jim now with thoughts here. Jim, hi. Are you with us, Jim?
Hello.
Hi, Jim. Yeah, go ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Uh-huh.
Okay, sorry. I am very curious about a phenomena that I've never quite seen before, and that is that journalists, and particularly television and radio, whenever they're talking about the president, he comes on and he makes a tweet. He makes a comment like yesterday. They preface their remarks with something along the lines of, well, today the president made a false claim about this or that. or he has unsubstantiated claims. They negate everything he says based on what they say is, well, he has no proof. It seems to me that the commentator or the journalist has no proof that what he is saying is untrue. And I base that on the, on what I hear on conservative radio and et cetera, because it seems to me that there are some pretty legitimate reasons for some of the things he's saying. And there seems to be a long history of this in the last 4 years where things are not brought up, or, well, we don't want to cover Hunter Biden, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm really concerned about this notion that a talk show host or journalist, whatever you want to call them, radio, television, constantly negate everything he says with this, well, it's a false claim.
And Jim, let's pause there on commentators and how the media handles President Trump. We have Rachel Kleinfeld of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as our guide. You can join in with your comments as well, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss elections in America. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. President Trump's campaign has filed lawsuits in Georgia, Michigan, and Pennsylvania challenging the validity of ballot counting in those states. His campaign also announced it would request a recount here in Wisconsin, where Biden won by 20,535 votes. Should there be vote recounts in states where the results are close? Should the president file lawsuits? What do you want to know about how our country's elections compare to other nations? Join in, 800-642-1234. Rachel Kleinfeld is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she's our guide for the hour. Rachel, we heard from Jim and Van Dyne, who says journalists preface the president's words that, you know, some news outlets broke away from his news conference early last night, not allowing the president to finish his remarks. How are news organizations handling the president's rhetoric, both in the campaign and post-election day?
So this is a really hard problem for news organizations, and it's also a really hard problem for the news industry generally. Basically, we know from psychology that when you repeat something over time, your brain believes it's true, whether it's true or not. Just the repetition makes people believe it's true. And so journalists have been cautioned that repeating false claims will do a disservice to their audiences. But because we're such a divided nation, people want to hear what they want to hear. They want to hear things that reaffirm their beliefs. And that's another psychological reality. When we hear things that reinforce what we already believe, your brain actually gives you a little hit of dopamine, just like you had taken a drug. It makes you feel good to be reassured that what you believe is true. And it makes you feel bad on the other side, and so people don't like that. And so what that means is that individual voters on both sides are looking more and more for reassurance, not for real news. And so that's driving news further and further into different rabbit holes, where the left is reading their news and the right is reading their news, and they're learning very different things about what reality is. And then you have your major news organizations that are used to representing a broad swath of the electorate trying to hold the center, and trying to do that in part by saying, by not repeating things that are factually false, and then being as fair as they can about things on which reasonable people can differ. And it is a really difficult job.
Where does this land then with the partisan polarization we see and this gaping divide, it seems, in our country? How do we reconcile that?
So Americans, if you compare us to the rest of the world, are among the most polarized people on earth. And that's not good. And we are not going to continue with a strong democracy unless we find a way to live together. I think it's pretty clear from this election and the last election that this is not a fluke. We have two sides of America who feel very differently about a lot of things. I think we might be misreading each other. When you look at the actual data on the electorate, the level of misinformation that each side holds about the other is vast. I mean, the average Democratic voter is a middle-aged white man who actually holds views that are not that dissimilar from the average Republican voter. But you wouldn't know that from the caricatures online that show the furthest right and the furthest left on either side. You can see it in the violence statistics, which is what I particularly keep an eye on. In a recent poll by More in Common, which is a depolarization group that works all around the world, they found that you had about 3 to 4% of Republicans and Democrats, about equal numbers, saying that violence was justified if they disagreed with the outcome of the election. But each side thought that the other side, 50%, would believe that violence was justified. 50%.
Wow.
It's amazing. And so the need here, I think, is to recognize, like many of us do within our own families, that we're all living in this country for a long time, and nobody wants violence. Nobody wants a civil war. Nobody wants the kinds of things that have turned our country inside out. And so, and the number, that's actually numbers. There are numbers on those too. And, you know, there are very, very few people who want that kind of thing. And so what we need to do is figure out ways to manage our differences.
And so I heard you say we're not going to build a strong democracy until we learn to live together. How do we learn to live together?
I think the most important first step is humanizing one another. That it's easy to, because we've geographically sorted, because we now live in local communities that tend to be fairly homogenous politically, it's really easy to be surrounded by your bubble. You're in your media bubble, where you're listening to conservative or liberal news. You're in a geographic bubble where most people around you echo those views. And it's very hard to break out. And so doing whatever we can to remember that, you know, we all are trying to raise our kids and grow our gardens and just do the normal things that human beings do, I think is quite important. The other thing is that we need to change some structural rules of the game that have been driving us apart. We didn't have this kind of polarization in prior decades, in part because the parties were much more mixed and in part because the rules to win were very different. We only had partisan primaries starting in about the 70s, and the idea had been to make the process more open and competitive, but what it did was really meant that the tiny percentage of electorates, usually 5% of a electorate will show up for a partisan primary. The most partisan of the most partisan determined who your candidate was. And then everyone else was going to fall pretty much in line, because if you leaned conservative, you were going to vote for the Republican. And if you leaned to the left, you were going to vote for the Democrat. That sort of structural change that happened in the 70s can be changed back. And they're trying to do that with things like ranked choice voting that allows for competition, but less partisan nature. That was on the ballot in Alaska. It won in Maine in the last cycle, just lost in Massachusetts. But you know, things that are structural that push us together and create less nasty campaigns will be quite important.
Talking with Rachel Kleinfeld, a Carnegie Endowment for International Peace senior fellow and author. She studies governance in fragile states and post-conflict countries. What do you want to know about how the U.S. elections compare to other democracies around the world? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in John, who is joining us from Jefferson this morning. Hi, John.
Good morning. My question is, if President Trump is able to file all these lawsuits, who gets stuck with the bill for those? Taxpayers, or does the Republican Party, or who has to pay for all that?
Who pays for litigation in elections, Rachel?
You know, I can't tell you definitively. My understanding is that if the Republican National Committee is launching a lawsuit, and most of the lawsuits have been coming from the RNC, from the president's side, that the RNC would pay, and then the RNC would fundraise for those legal expenses. You know, you hear that in fundraising ads that we're running lawsuits and please help us, and that kind of thing. So that's my understanding. The recounts, as I said before, if it's a small enough margin of error, the state sometimes pays, but that's not my understanding of lawsuits. Although, of course, when a lawsuit is launched and if the state has to defend itself, the state and the government does pay on the other side, the judges, the time of the court clerks, all of that sort of thing. It's built in, but particularly more frivolous lawsuits, you are causing a cost to the government, and then we're all paying because we're all taxpayers.
How does social media, the tweets, how does that factor into elections?
So social media in healthy democracies has not played a big role in polarizing electorates and harming elections. So in most of European democracies, for instance, we see very little increase in polarization from social media. It's not a big factor. In less healthy democracies where there is more polarization, social media inflames it in a big way. And we see that in Sri Lanka, in parts of Indonesia and so on. And we see it here. So Facebook noted that it had a huge increase in violent threats and incitement over the last few days, a 45% increase in their metric for violence and incitement for violence since October 31st. And I'm on a group that tracks that sort of thing as well. And it's getting uncomfortable to see what's going on online. And that's because we're so polarized. It's not because of the social media itself.
Should we be expecting more out of Facebook and Twitter to police that type of rhetoric on social media?
Absolutely. I think, but I also think it's important to differentiate a little bit between the different platforms. The National Election Task Force and many others have been in conversation with these platforms for many, many months. They've been attempting at differential levels to be responsible in this election. You'll see if you go on Twitter, these big posts right at the top of your Twitter feed saying election results are likely to be delayed and there's no big deal and it's going to take a while to count all the votes. Facebook has been less responsive, frankly, but I think they're starting to believe they need to build in what they call friction. This means that when you're sending a post or you're sending something where their algorithm looks at it and says, this doesn't look so good, this could be an incitement to violence, they ask you, are you sure you want to send this? Do you really mean it? They're not stopping you. They're just trying to get you to think for a second, because what the research shows is that when you think for a second before sending a link, you know, it's like sending those emails when you're angry at someone and that you regret immediately. When you think for a second, you sometimes don't send them. And so they're trying to build in a little more friction. But frankly, they should have done it a long time ago.
So it's really slowing it down, slowing down the communication in order to protect democracy.
That's right. And by slowing down, we're not talking about a major slow. I mean, they're asking you to click twice. You know, do you really want to send this? Yes, go for it. So we're talking about a half a second, a third of a second, but just enough to get you to think before clicking and sending something that could further inflame a situation. And yes, this is the kind of thing that the media really does need to start thinking about doing as we move into a situation where our democracy is more on edge.
Talking with Rachel Kleinfeld, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, as we talk about elections in America, other countries around the world. What are you thinking about our elections process? What can we learn from this moment? Has the partisan divide gone too far? And can we heal as a nation, find that common ground? Still time to talk. Talk it out. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Rachel Kleinfeld here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Rachel Kleinfeld. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on rule of law, security, governance in fragile states. She's on the National Task Force on Election Crises, and she stays with us for 10 more minutes. Rachel, I want to circle back with you on the National Task Force on Election Crises and the work you're doing there. You talked briefly about the scenarios that you had worked through. What is the goal of this task force?
The goal was to ensure that America had free, fair elections and that we had a peaceful and positive continuation of power if Trump won and transition of power if Joe Biden won. And our concern was sparked about 2 years ago by the way the elections went in 2018, everything from the extremely long lines, which we know deter people in future years from voting. You know, if you wait 5 or 6 hours in a line, next time you might think twice before taking your hour of lunch break to try again. So it was everything from those kinds of technical challenges to the partisan rhetoric and polarization and legal challenges that we were seeing building up. and we wanted to plan ahead.
Who serves on the task force? Is it a big group?
It's a group of, I think, about 80 of us, and it ranges from people like Jim Baker and Michael Chertoff. Jim Baker, you know, he served practically every role in government, from running the Republican recount in Florida to, you know, being at a number of Republican president's sides. Michael Chertoff was the Department of Homeland Security secretary for a number of years, all the way to people who audit elections in places like Colorado and pick how many pens they need to buy in a situation of pandemic and make the decisions like, do we give a voter a pen and let them keep that pen, or do we need to take the pen back and put sanitizer on it? So it really had a very broad range of expertise to bring to bear on the different kinds of problems that could affect our elections.
Let's bring in Jody from Downing with thoughts on the election. Jody, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling. I work a lot in Latin America and work with artisans from all over the world. So I've seen, or I'm hearing what they see, how they see our elections, which is, you know, it's just such a gift for us to be able to have these democracies. And it's just been crazy for them to watch how it's going. But I actually took part in a group called Western Wisconsin Votes. And we were what they call deep listening, where we called to independent, sporadic voters and just really tried to listen and have a conversation. And it wasn't really about convincing them. It was just about trying to open up the dialogue and mainly listen to them. And I don't know if it was super effective, but it at least felt like I was doing something more positive than, you know, calling up and trying to convince somebody that's never going to listen to me. But anyway, I totally agree with you that we need to do more to open up, to come together on, there's so many things we do have in common versus these little stakes we're putting between ourselves.
Jody, thank you. And Rachel, what do you consider out of deep listening and opening up more dialogue, communication?
So I think that it's wonderful. And I think that when you do this kind of thing, either on a one-on-one scale or on a broader scale, as some of these democratic dialogues that have been held where they get 100 people in a convention hall for a day or two and have them deliberate about really difficult and contentious topics and tend to find that they have a lot more in common. And that is borne out statistically, too, that when you look at what people actually believe about very contentious issues, immigration, gun control, abortion, there's actually a great deal of bipartisan consensus in America. So I think they're really valuable. They do need to be done correctly. You can do it poorly and increase polarization, but it sounds like this one was done very well. I do think that on that human level, we need to reconnect, but that it won't make a change in our body politic until we change some of the rules of the game by which politicians win their elections, in part by driving us apart. And so we need to do both. We need to deeply listen and reconnect with one another, and we also need to change these rules, because the reality is that the people who are going to deep listen are the people who are more inclined to listen anyway. And the people who are less inclined are not going to do it, you know?
Right. Well, you know, listening, deep listening takes time. It takes energy. We're in really desperate times here. People are out of work. They're hungry. They're not exactly in a position, perhaps, to listen.
That's true. But I think you can also have some empathy. And again, coming back to that idea of humanizing. I mean, let me just give you an anecdote. My car had a radiator problem, and I took it to the shop at the beginning of last week, and it took extra long to get fixed. And so I picked it up the day after the election. Now, I have no idea how my mechanic votes. I know he's a very good at mechanic, and I appreciate that. And the day after the election, he made some comments that made me think that he probably voted the other way from me. But that doesn't mean I can't have a relationship with him where we can still talk about the fact that he had a dental problem while he was out hunting that needed help, and that he was a human being who had just fixed my car, which I appreciated, right? We can connect on other levels and remember that we're human, even in these small moments when we're doing our normal lives. And I think that's what's important to keep our country together. while we work on the bigger fixes, on some of the structural things that will take the temperature down, on the courts, on the ways we elect our politicians, and for those who have the time, on the kinds of deeper deliberative exercises that let us see we're not so far apart even on policy.
I'm going to reintroduce you. Rachel Kleinfeld is here, scholar, national security and peaceful transitions of power expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Let's bring in Matt, who is joining us from Mellon. Hi, Matt. What would you like to say?
Well, some of my concerns were addressed with the previous caller, but I'm wondering if we can't humanize each other by maybe citizen committees where you have the rural people speaking with the city people, suburbs, getting more of a human connection there and seeing where the polarization is coming from.
Matt, thank you for that. And certainly getting out of your neighborhood, getting out of your community, it sounds like, Rachel.
The core divide in America right now is a rural-urban divide. That layers atop our partisan divide, which also breaks down rural-urban. It layers atop racial divides, although those are weakening a little bit. That's part of the good news of this election, that President Trump gained more from some of minority groups. That's actually a positive thing in terms of our racial divide not being quite so stark, and religious divides. And one of the reasons we're so polarized is that all these build on each other. But I come from Fairbanks, Alaska, and one of the things that I realized when I moved to Washington, D.C., was just how different life is when you live in a rural area than a city, and just how hard it is for people to understand across that particular divide. I remember having to enforce, in an early job with City Hall, enforce rules about how long people's grass should be. And I just thought, well, how dare City Hall tell people how long their grass should be? But of course, if you live in a city, that brings down other people's property values. And so it's just different. So yes, I think having people understand what guns mean in rural areas versus cities, what rules and regulations mean in rural areas versus cities, these are very important. I don't think, again, that they will work on their own. I do think we need structural change. But I think by humanizing and understanding each other, what it'll help us do is not simply work to help our side win, but help us work to make our democracy win and those structural changes come to bear.
We only have a few seconds left, but where do you find hope?
I find hope in the number of Americans who turned out, who care about the process. That's much better than tuning out and deciding that they don't care. So that's wonderful. And I find hope in the fact that a lot of minorities voted in ways that they aren't used to voting and that our racial blocks are breaking up a little bit and they're seeing different things in different parties. Whatever you think of the different parties, it's good not to be polarized along so many lines at the same time. And I find hope in the vast number of citizen groups that came out to make sure that this election was free, fair, and peaceful, not just the National Task Force, but across the country, thousands of groups. Work to make sure voters understood the new voting rules in their states, to make sure that people who needed help during the pandemic got that help to vote, to fill polls when poll workers who were older couldn't come to the polls. You had unprecedented numbers of high schoolers and college-age students powering the polls. These are great things, and these give me hope for a long-term democracy.
Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rachel Kleinfeld, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Just ahead, it's 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.